This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents Water Sleeps, written by Glenn Cook and narrated by McLeod Andrews.
Chapter 1. In those days, the Black Company did not exist. This I know because there were laws and decrees that told me so. But I did not feel entirely insubstantial. The company standard, its captain and lieutenant, its standard bearer, and all the men who had made the company so terrible had passed on, having been buried alive at the heart of a vast desert of stone. Glittering stone, they whispered in the streets and alleys of Taglios. And gone to Kadavar, they proclaimed from on high. The mighty making what they had been so determined to prevent for so long over into a great triumph, once the Radisha or Protector or somebody decided that people ought to believe that the company had fulfilled its destiny. Anyone old enough to remember the company knew better. Only 50 people had ventured out onto that plain of glittering stone. Half of those people had not been company. Only 2 of those 50 had returned to lie about what had happened. And a third who had come back to retell the truth had been killed in the Kialune Wars, far away from the capital. But the deceits of Soulcatcher and Willow Swan fooled no one, then or now. People simply pretended to believe them because that was safer. They might have asked why Mogaba needed 5 years to conquer a company that had passed on, squandering thousands of young lives to bring the Kialune domains under the Radisha's rule and into the realm of the Protector's twisted truths. They might have mentioned that people claiming to be Black Company had held out in the Fortress Overlook for years after that, until the Protector, Soulcatcher, finally became so impatient with their intransigence that she invested her own best sorceries in a 2-year project that reduced that huge fortress to white powder, white rubble, and white bones. They might have raised these points, but they remained silent instead. They were afraid. With cause, they were afraid. The Taglian Empire under the Protectorate is an empire of fear. During the years of defiance, one unknown hero won Soulcatcher's eternal hatred by sabotaging the Shadow Gate, the sole gateway to the Glittering Plain. Soulcatcher was the most powerful sorcerer alive. She might have become a Shadow Master to eclipse those monsters the company had pulled down during its earlier wars on Taglios's behalf. But with the Shadow Gate sealed, she could not conjure killer shadows more powerful than the few score she had controlled when she worked her treachery on the company. Oh, she could open the Shadow Gate. One time. She did not know how to close it again, though. Meaning everything inside would be free to wriggle out and begin tormenting the world. Meaning that for Soulcatcher, party to so few of the secrets, the choice must be all or very little. The end of the world, or making do? For the moment, she is making do, and pursuing continuous researches. She is the Protector. Fear of her steeps the Empire. There are no challenges to her terror. But even she knows this age of dark concord cannot endure. Water sleeps. In their homes, in the shadowed alleyways, in the city's 10,000 temples, nervous whispers never cease. The year of the skulls. The year of the skulls. It is an age when no gods die, and those that sleep keep stirring restlessly. In their homes, in the shadowed alleyways or fields of grain, or in the sodden paddies, in the pastures and forests and tributary cities, should a comet be seen in the sky, or should an unseasonable storm strew devastation, or, particularly, if the earth should shake, they murmur, "Water sleeps." and they are afraid. Chapter 2. They call me Sleepy. I was withdrawn as a child, hiding from the horrors of my childhood, inside the comfort and emotional safety of daydreams and nightmares. Any time I did not have to work, I went away in there to hide. The evil could not touch me there. I knew no safer place till the Black Company came to Jaikur. My brothers accused me of sleeping all the time. They resented my ability to get away. They did not understand. They died without ever understanding. I slept on. I did not waken fully till I had been with the company for several years. I keep these annals today. Somebody must, and no one else can. Though the analyst title never devolved upon me formally. There is precedent. The books must be written. The truth must be recorded, even if fate decrees that no man ever reads a word I write. The annals are the soul of the Black Company. They recall that this is who we are, that this is who we were, that we persevere, and that treachery, as it ever has, failed to suck the last drop of our blood. We no longer exist. The Protector tells us so. The Radisha swears it. Mugaba, that mighty general with his 1,000 dark honors, sneers at our memory and spits on our name. People in the streets declare us no more than an evil, haunting memory. But only Soulcatcher does not watch over both shoulders to see what might be gaining ground. We are stubborn ghosts. We will not lie down. We will not cease to haunt them. We have done nothing for a long time, but they remain afraid. Their guilt cannot stop whispering our name. They should be afraid. Somewhere in Taglios, every day a message appears upon a wall, written in chalk or paint or even animal blood. Just a gentle reminder. Water sleeps. Everyone knows what that means. They whisper it, aware that there is an enemy out there more restless than running water, an enemy who will somehow, someday, lurch forth from the mouth of his grave and come for those who played at betrayal. They know no power that can prevent it. They were warned 10,000 times before they gave in to temptation. No evil can preserve them. Mugaba is afraid. Radisha is afraid. Willow's swan is so afraid he barely functions, like the wizard Smoke before him, who he indicted and tormented for his cowardice. Swan knew the company of old in the north, before anyone here recognized it as more than a dark memory of ancient terror. The years have seen no calluses form on Swan's fear. Pirohita Drupada is afraid. Inspector General Gochel is afraid. Only the Protector is not afraid. Soulcatcher fears nothing. Soulcatcher does not care. She mocks and defies the demon. She is mad. She will laugh and be entertained while being consumed by fire. Her lack of fear leaves her henchmen that much more troubled. They know she will drive them before her into the grinding jaws of destiny. Occasionally, a wall will carry another message, a more personal note. All their days are numbered. I am in the streets every day, either going to work, going to spy, listening, capturing rumors, or launching new ones within the anonymity of Chorbagan. The thieves' garden, even the greys have not yet been able to extirpate. I used to disguise myself as a prostitute, but that proved to be too dangerous. There are people out there who make the Protectors seem a paragon of sanity. It is the world's great good fortune that fate denies them the power to exercise the fullest depth and sweep of their psychoses. Mostly I go around as a young man, the way I always did. Rootless young men are everywhere since the end of the wars. The more bizarre the new rumor, the faster it explodes out of Chorbagan, and the more strongly it gnaws the nerves of our enemies. Always, always, Taglios must enjoy a sense of grim premonition. We must provide them their ration of omens, signs, and portents. The Protector hunts us in her more lucid moments, but she never remains interested long. She cannot keep her attention fixed on anything. And why should she be concerned? We are dead. We no longer exist. She herself has declared that to be the reality. As Protector, she is the great arbiter of reality for the entire Taglian Empire. But water sleeps. Chapter 3. In those days the spine of the company was a woman who never formally joined, the witch Kaisara, wife of my predecessor as analyst, Murgan, the standard-bearer. Kaisara was a clever woman with a will like sharp steel. Even Goblin and One Eye deferred to her. She would not be intimidated, not even by her wicked old Uncle Doge. She feared the Protector, the Radisha, and the Greys no more than she feared a cabbage. The malice of evils as great as the deadly cult of deceivers, their Messiah, the daughter of Night, and their goddess Kina, intimidated Sara not at all. She had looked into the heart of darkness. Its secrets inspired in her no dread. Only one thing made Sara tremble. Her mother, Kai Gota, was the incarnation of dissatisfaction and complaint. Her lamentations and reproaches were of such amazing potency that it seemed she must be an avatar of some cranky old deity as yet undiscovered by man. Nobody loves Kai Gota except One Eye, and even he calls her the troll behind her back. Sara shuddered as her mother limped slowly through a room gone suddenly silent. We were not in power now. We had to use the same few rooms for everything. Only a short while ago, this one had been filled with loafers. Some company. Most of them employees of Bondo Trang. We all stared at the old woman, willing her to hurry, willing her to overlook this opportunity to socialize. Old Do Trang, who was so feeble he was confined to a wheelchair, rolled over to Kai Gota, evidently hoping a show of concern would keep her moving. Everyone always wanted Gota to go somewhere else. This time his sacrifice worked. She had to be in a lot of discomfort, though not to take time to harangue all who were younger than she. Silence persisted till the old merchant returned. He owned the place and let us use it as our operational headquarters. He owed us nothing, but nevertheless shared our danger out of love for Sara. In all matters, his thoughts had to be heard and his wishes had to be honored. Do Trang was not gone long. He came back rolling wearily. The man behind the liver spots seemed so fragile. It had to be a miracle that he could move his chair himself. Ancient he was, but there was an irrepressible twinkle in his eyes. He nodded. He seldom had anything to say unless someone else said something incredibly stupid. He was a good man. Sara told us, "Everything is in place. Every phase and facet has been double-checked. Goblin and One Eye are sober. It's time the company speaks up." She glanced around, inviting comments. I did not think it was time, but I had said my piece when I was planning this, and had been outvoted. I treated myself to a shrug of despair. There being no new objections, Sara said, "Start the first phase." She waved at her son. Tobo nodded and slipped out. He was a skinny, scruffy, furtive youngster. He was Nguyen Bao, which meant he had to be a sneak and a thief. His every move had to be watched, In consequence, he was so generally observed that no individual examined in detail what he actually did, so long as his hands did not stray toward a dangling purse or some treasure in a vendor's stall. People did not look for what they did not expect to see. The boy's hands stayed behind his back. While they were there, he was not considered a threat. He could not steal. No one noticed the small, discolored blobs he left on any wall he leaned against. Goony children stared. The boy looked so strange in his black pajama clothing. Goony raised their children polite. Goony are peaceable folk in the main. Shadar children, though, are wrought of sterner stuff. They are more bold. Their religion has a warrior philosophy at its root. Some Shadar youths set out to harass the thief. Of course he was a thief. He was Nuang Bao. Everyone knew all Nuang Bao were thieves. Older Shadar called the youngsters off. The thief would be dealt with by those whose responsibility that was. The Shadar religion has its streak of bureaucratic rectitude, too. Even such a small commotion attracted official attention. Three tall, gray-clad, bearded Shadar peacekeepers wearing white turbans advanced through the press. They looked around constantly, intently oblivious to the fact that they traveled in an island of open space. The streets of Taglios are packed day and night, yet the masses always find room to shrink away from the grays. The grays are all men with hard eyes, seemingly chosen for their lack of patience and compassion. Tobo drifted away, sliding through the mob like a black snake through swamp reeds. When the Greys inquired about the commotion, no one could describe him as anything but what prejudice led them to presume. A Nuang Bao thief. And there was a plague of those in Taglios. These days the capital city boasted plenty of every kind of outlander imaginable. Every layabout and lackwit and sharpster from the length and breadth of the empire was migrating to the city. The population had tripled in a generation. But for the cruel efficiencies of the Greys, Taglios would have become a chaotic, murderous sink, a hellfire fueled by poverty and despair. Poverty and despair existed in plentitude, but the palace did not let any disorder take root. The palace was good at ferreting out secrets. Criminal careers tended to be short, as did the lives of most who sought to conspire against the Radisha or the Protector. Particularly against the Protector, who did not concern herself deeply with the sanctity of anyone else's skin. In times past, intrigue and conspiracy had been a miasmatic plague afflicting every life in Taglios. There was little of that anymore. The Protector did not approve. Most Taglians were eager to win the Protector's approval. Even the priesthoods avoided attracting Soulcatcher's evil eye. At some point the boy's black clothing came off, leaving him in the Goonie-style loincloth he had worn underneath. Now he looked like any other youngster, though with a slightly jaundiced cast of skin. He was safe. He had grown up in Taglios. He had no accent to give him away. Chapter 4 It was the waiting time, the stillness, the doing nothing that there is so much of before any serious action. I was out of practice. I could not lean back and play tonk or just watch while One-Eye and Goblin tried to cheat each other. And I had writer's cramp, so could not work on my annals. Tobo, I called. You want to go see it happen? Tobo was 14. He was the youngest of us. He grew up in the Black Company. He had a full measure of youth's exuberance and impatience and overconfidence in his own immortality and divine exemption from retribution. He enjoyed his assignments on behalf of the company. He was not quite sure he believed in his father. He never knew the man. We tried hard to keep him from becoming anyone's spoiled baby, but Goblin insisted on treating him like a favorite son. He was trying to tutor the boy. Goblin's command of written Taglian was more limited than he would admit. There are 100 characters in the everyday Vulgate, and 40 more reserved to the priests, who write in the high mode, which is almost a second unspoken formal language. I use a mixture recording these annals. Once Tobo could read, Uncle Goblin made him do all his reading for him aloud. "Could I do some more buttons, Sleepy? Mom thinks more would get more attention in the palace." I was surprised he talked to her that long. Boys his age are surly at best. He was rude to his mother all the time. He would have been ruder and more defiant still if he had not been blessed with so many uncles who would not tolerate that stuff. Naturally, Tobo saw all that as a grand conspiracy of adults. Publicly. In private, he was amenable to reason. Occasionally. When approached delicately by someone who was not his mother. "Maybe a few. But it's going to get dark soon. And then the show will start."
"What do we go as? I don't like it when you're a whore."
"We'll be street orphans." Though that had its risks, too. We could get caught by a press gang and forced into Mugabe's army. His soldiers these days are little better than slaves, subject to a savage discipline. Many are petty criminals given an option of rough justice or enlistment. The rest are children of poverty with nowhere else to go. Which was the standard of professional armies, men like Mergen saw in the far north long before my time.
"Why do you worry so much about disguises?"
"If we never show the same face twice, our enemies can't possibly know who they're looking for. Don't ever underestimate them. Especially not the Protector. She's outwitted death itself more than once." Tobo was not prepared to believe that or much else of our exotic history. Though not as bad as most, he was going through that stage where he knew everything worth knowing and nothing his elders said, particularly if it bore any vaguely educational hue, was worth hearing. He could not help that. It went with the age. And I was my age, and could not help saying things I knew would do no good. "It's in the annals. Your father and the captain didn't make up stories." He did not want to believe that either. I did not pursue it. Each of us must learn to respect the annals in our own way, in our own time. The company's diminished circumstance makes it difficult for anyone to grasp tradition. Only two old crew brothers both survived Soulcatcher's trap on the stone plain and the Kialune wars afterward. Goblin and One-Eye are haplessly inept at transmitting the company mystique. One-Eye is too lazy and Goblin too inarticulate. And I was still practically an apprentice when the old crew ventured onto the plain in the captain's quest for Katavar. Which he did not find. Not the Katavar he was looking for, anyway. I am amazed. Before long, I will be a 20-year veteran. I was barely 14 when Bucket took me under his wing. But I was never like Tobo. At 14, I was already ancient in pain. For years after Bucket rescued me, I grew younger.
"What?"
"I asked why you looked so angry all of a sudden." "I was remembering when I was 14.
"Girls have it so easy."
He shut up. His face drained. His northern ancestry became apparent. He was an arrogant and spoiled little puke. But he did have brains enough to recognize it when he stepped into a nest of poisonous snakes. I told him what he knew, not what he did not. When I was 14, the company and Yuangbo were trapped in Jaekur. Dejagore, they call it here. The rest does not matter anymore. The rest is safely in the past. I almost never have nightmares now. Tobo had heard more than he ever wanted to about Jaekur already. His mother and grandmother and Uncle Doge had been there, too.
"Goblin says we'll be impressed by these buttons," Tobo whispered. "They won't just make spooky lights. They'll prick somebody's conscience."
"That'll be unusual." Conscience was a rare commodity on either side of our dispute. You really knew my dad?
Tobo had heard stories all his life, but lately wanted to know more. Morgan had begun to matter in a more than lip service fashion. I told him what I had told him before. He was my boss. He taught me to read and write. He was a good man. I laughed weakly. As good a man as belonging to the Black Company, let him be. Tobo stopped. He took a deep breath. He stared at a point in the dusk somewhere above my left shoulder.
Were you lovers?
No, Tobo. No, friends. Almost. But definitely not that. He didn't know I was a woman till just before he left for the glittering plain. And I didn't know he knew till I read his annals. Nobody knew. They thought I was a cute runt who just never got any bigger. I let them think that. It felt safer as one of the guys.
Oh.
His tone was so neutral, I had to wonder. Why did you even ask? Surely he had no reason to believe I had behaved differently before he knew me. He shrugged.
I just wondered.
Something must have set him off. Possibly an I wonder if, from Goblin or One Eye, say, while they were sampling some of their homemade elephant poison. I didn't ask. Did you put the buttons behind the shadow show?
That's what I was told to do.
A shadow show uses cutout puppets mounted on sticks. Some of their limbs are manipulated mechanically. A candle behind the puppets casts their shadows on a screen of white cloth. The puppeteer uses a variety of voices to tell his story as he maneuvers his puppets. If he is sufficiently entertaining, his audience will toss him a few coins. This particular puppeteer had performed in the same place for more than a generation. He slept inside his stage setup. In so doing, he lived better than most of Tagliosa's floating population. He was an informer. He was not beloved of the Black Company. The story he told, as most were, was drawn from the myths. It sprang from the Kadi cycle. It involves a goddess with too many arms who kept devouring demons. Of course it was the same demon puppet over and over. Kind of like real life, where the same demon comes back again and again. Just a hint of color hung above the western rooftops. There was an ear-splitting squeal. People stopped to stare at a bright orange light. Glowing orange smoke wobbled up from behind the puppeteer's stand. Its strands wove the well-known emblem of the Black Company, a fanged skull with no lower jaw, exhaling flames. The scarlet fire in its left eye socket seemed to be a pupil that stared right down inside you, searching for the thing that you feared the most. The smoke thing persisted only a few seconds. It rose about 10 feet before it dispersed. It left a frightened silence. The air itself seemed to whisper. Water sleeps. Whine and flash. A second skull arose. This one was silver with a slightly bluish tint. It lasted longer and rose a 12 feet higher before it perished. It whispered, "My brother unforgiven."
"Here come the Greys!"
exclaimed someone tall enough to see over the crowd. Being short makes it easy for me to disappear in groups, but also makes it tough for me to see what is happening outside them. The Greys are never far away, but they are helpless against this sort of thing. It can happen anywhere, any time, and has to happen before they can react. Our supposed ironclad rule is that perpetrators should never be nearby when the buttons speak. The Greys understand that. They just go through the motions. The protector must be appeased. The little Shadar have to be fed.
"Now!"
Tobo murmured as 4 Greys arrived. A shriek erupted from behind the puppeteer's stage. The puppeteer himself ran out, spun, and leaned toward his stage, mouth wide open. There was a flash, less bright but more persistent than its predecessors.
The subsequent smoke image was more complex and lasted longer. It appeared to be a monster. The monster focused on the Shadar. One of the greys mouthed the name,
Niasi.
Niasi would be a major demon from Shadar mythology. A similar demon under another form of the name exists in Guni belief. Niasi was a chieftain of the inner circle of the most powerful demons. Shadar beliefs being heretical, Vedna include a posthumous, punitive hell, but also definitely include the possibility of a Guni-like hell on Earth, in life, managed by demons in Niasi's employ, laid on for the particularly wicked. Despite understanding that they were being taunted, the Greys were rocked. This was something new. This was an attack from an unanticipated and sensitive direction. And it came on top of ever more potent rumors associating the Greys with vile rites supposedly practiced by the Protector. Children disappear. Reason suggests this is inevitable and unavoidable in a city so vast and overcrowded, even if there is not one evil man out there. Babies vanish by wandering off and getting lost. And horrible things do happen to good people. A clever sick rumor can reassign the numb evil of chance to the premeditated malice of people no one ever trusted anyway. Memory becomes selective. We do not mind a bit lying about our enemies. Tobo yelled something insulting. I started to pull him away, dragging him toward our den. Others began to curse and mock the Greys. Tobo threw a stone that hit a Grey's turban. It was too dark for them to make out faces. They began to unlimber bamboo wands. The mood of the crowd turned ugly. I could not help but suspect that there was more to the devil display than had met the eye. I knew our tame wizards, and I knew that Taglians do not lose control easily. It takes a great deal of patience and self-control for so many people to live in such unnaturally tight proximity. I looked around for crows, fluttering bats, or anything else that might be spies for their protector. After nightfall, all our risks soar. We cannot see what might be watching. I held onto Tobo's arm. You shouldn't have done that. It's dark enough for shadows to be out. He was not impressed. Goblin will be happy. He spent a long time on that, and it worked perfectly. The Greys blew whistles, summoning reinforcements. A fourth button released its smoke ghost. We missed the show. I dragged Tobo through all the shadow traps between the excitement and our headquarters. He would be explaining to some uncles soon. Those for whom paranoia remains a way of life will be those who will be around to savor the company's many revenges. Tobo needed more instruction. His behavior could have been exploited by a clever adversary. Chapter 5. Sara summoned me as soon as we arrived, not to chastise me for letting Tobo take stupid risks, but to observe as she launched her next move. It might be time Tobo walked into something that would scare some sense into him. Life underground is unforgiving. It seldom gives you more than one chance. Tobo had to understand that in his heart. After Sara grilled me about events outside, she made sure Goblin and One Eye were acquainted with her displeasure, too. Tobo was not there to defend himself. Goblin and One Eye were not cowed. No 40-something slip of a lass could overawe those two antiques. Besides, they put Tobo up to half his mischief. Sara said, I'll raise Murgan now. She seemed unsure about that. She had not consulted Murgan much recently. We all wondered why. She and Murgan were a genuine romantic love match straight out of legend, with all the appurtenances seen in the timeless stories, including gods defied, parents disappointed, desperate separations and reunions, intrigues by enemies, and so forth. It remained only for one of them to go down into the realm of the dead to rescue the other. and Morgan was tucked away in a nice cold underground hell right now, courtesy of the mad sorceress Soulcatcher. He and all the captured lived on, in stasis, beneath the plane of glittering stone, in a place and situation known to us only because Sarah could conjure Morgan's spirit. Could the problem be the stasis? Sarah got a day older every day. Morgan did not. Had she begun to fear she would be older than his mother before we freed the captured? Sadly, after years of study, I realized that most history may really pivot on personal considerations like that, not on the pursuit of ideals dark or shining. Long ago, Morgan learned to leave his flesh while he slept. He retained some of that ability, but sadly, it was diminished by the supernatural constraints of his captivity. He could do nothing outside the cavern of the ancients without being summoned forth by Sarah, or, conceivably, chillingly, by any other necromancer who knew how to reach him. Morgan's ghost was the ultimate spy. Outside our circle, none but Soulcatcher could detect his presence. Morgan informed us of our enemies' every plot, those that we suspected strongly enough to ask Sarah to investigate. The process was cumbersome and limited, but still, Morgan constituted our most potent weapon. We could not survive without him. And Sarah was ever more reluctant to call him up. God knows it is hard to keep believing. Many of our brothers have lost their faith and have drifted away, vanishing into the chaos of the Empire. Some may be rejuvenated once we have had a flashy success or two. The years have been painful for Sarah. They cost her 3 children, an agony no loving parent should have to bear. She lost their father as well, but suffered little by that deprivation. No one who remembered the man spoke well of him. She suffered with the rest of us during the siege of Jaekur. Maybe Sarah and the entire Nyuengbo people had angered Gangesha. Or maybe the god with the several elephant heads just enjoyed a cruel prank at the expense of her worshippers. Certainly Kina got a chuckle out of pulling lethal practical jokes on her devotees. Goblin and One-Eye were not usually present when Sarah raised Morgan. She did not need their help. Her powers were narrow but strong, and those two could be a distraction even when they tried to behave. Those antiques being there told me something unusual was afoot. And old they are, almost beyond reckoning. Their skills sustain them. One Eye, if the annals do not lie, is on the downhill side of 200. His youthful sidekick lags less than a century behind. Neither is a big man, which is being generous. Both are shorter than me, and never were taller, even long before they became dried-up old relics. Which was probably when they were about 15. I cannot imagine One Eye ever having been anything but old. He must have been born old, and wearing the ugliest, filthiest black hat that ever existed. Maybe One Eye goes on forever because of the curse of that hat. Maybe the hat uses him as its steed and depends on him for its survival. That crusty, stinking glob of felt rag will hit the nearest fire before One-Eye's corpse finishes bouncing. Everyone hates it. Goblin, in particular, loathes that hat. He mentions it whenever he and One-Eye get into a squabble, which is about as often as they see one another. One Eye is small and black and wrinkled. Goblin is small and white and wrinkled. He has a face like a dried toad's. One Eye mentions that whenever they get into a squabble, which is about as often as there is an audience, but nobody to get between them. They strain to be on their best behavior around Sarah, though. The woman has a gift. She brings out the best in people. Except her mother, though the troll is much worse away from her daughter. Lucky us, we do not see Kaigoda much. Her joints hurt her too bad. Tobo helps care for her. Our cynical exploitation of his special immunity from her vitriol. She dotes on the boy, even if his father was foreign slime. Sarah told me, These two claim they've found a more effective way to materialize Murgan. So you can communicate directly. Usually Sara had to talk for Murgan after she raised him up. I do not have a psychic ear. I said, if you bring him across strong enough so the rest of us can see and hear him, then Tobo ought to be here too. He suddenly got a lot of questions about his father. Sara peered at me oddly. I was saying something, but she did not get what I meant.
Boy ought to know his old man,
One Eye rasped. He stared at Goblin, waiting to be contradicted by a man who did not know his. That was their custom. Pick a fight, and never mind trivia like facts or common sense. The debate about whether or not they were worth the trouble they caused went back for generations. This time Goblin abstained. He would make his rebuttal when Sara was not around to embarrass him with an appeal to reason. Sara nodded to One Eye. But first, we have to see if your scheme really works. One Eye began to puff up. Somebody dared suggest that his sorcery needed field testing? Come on! Forget the record! This time! I told him, don't start. Time had caught up with One Eye. His memory was no longer reliable, and lately he tended to nod off in the middle of things, or to forget what had gotten him exercised when he roared off on a rant. Sometimes he ended up contradicting himself. He was a shadow of the dried-up old relic he was when first I met him, though he got around under his own power still. But halfway through any journey, he was likely to forget where he was bound. Occasionally, that was good, him being One Eye, but mostly it was a pain. Tobo usually got the job of keeping him headed in the right direction when it mattered. One Eye doted on the kid, too. The little wizard's increasing fragility did make it easier to keep him inside, away from the temptations of the city. One moment of indiscretion could kill us all. And One Eye never quite caught on to what it meant to be discreet. Goblin chuckled as One Eye subsided. I suggested, could you two concentrate on what you're supposed to be doing? I was haunted by the dread that one day One Eye would doze off in the midst of a deadly spell and leave us all up to our ears in demons or blood-sucking insects, distraught about having been plucked from some swamp 1,000 miles away. This is important.
It's always important, Goblin grumbled. Even when it's just Goblin, give me a hand here. I'm too lazy to polish the silver myself. They make it sound like the world's about to end. Always important?
I see you're in a good mood tonight.
Grouk.
One Eye heaved himself out of his chair, leaning on his cane, muttering unflattering remarks about me. He shuffled over to Sara. He had forgotten I was female. He was less unpleasant when he remembered, though I expect no special treatment because of the unhappy chance of birth. One Eye became dangerous in a whole new way the day he adopted that cane. He used it to swat people, or to trip them. He was always falling asleep between here and there, but you never knew for sure if his nap was the real thing. That cane might dart out to tangle your legs if he was pretending. The dread we all shared was that One Eye would not last much longer. Without him, our chances to continue avoiding detection would plummet. Goblin would try hard, but he was just one small-time wizard. Our situation offered work for more than two in their prime.
Start, woman, One Eye rasped. Goblin, you worthless sack of beetle snot. Would you get that stuff over here? I don't want to hang around here all night.
Sara had had a table set up for them. She used no props herself. At a fixed time, she would concentrate on Murgan. She usually made contact quickly. At her time of the month, when her sensitivity went down, she would sing in Yuengbo. Unlike some of my company brothers, I have a poor ear for languages. Yuengbo mostly eludes me. Her songs seem to be lullabies, unless the words have double meanings, which is entirely possible. Uncle Doge talks in riddles all the time, but insists he makes perfect sense if we would just listen. Uncle Doge is not around much, thank God. He has his own agenda. Though even he does not seem clear on what that is anymore. The world keeps changing on him, not in ways he likes. Goblin brought a sack of objects without challenging One-Eye's foul manners. He deferred to One-Eye more lately, if only for efficiency's sake. He wasted no time making his opinions known, if work was not involved, though. Even though they were cooperating, laying out their tools, they began bickering about the placement of every instrument. I wanted to paddle them like they were 4-year-olds. Sara began singing. She had a beautiful voice. It should not have been buried this way. Strictly speaking, she was not employing necromancy. She was not laying an absolute compulsion on Morgan, nor was she conjuring his shade. Morgan was still alive out there, but his spirit could escape his tomb when summoned. I wished the other captured could be called up too, especially the captain. We needed inspiration. A cloud of dust formed slowly between Goblin and One-Eye, who stood on opposite sides of the table. No, it was not dust, nor was it smoke. I stuck a finger in, tasted. That was a fine, cool water mist. Goblin told Sara,
"We're ready."
She changed tone. She began to sound almost wheedling. I could pick out even fewer words. Mergen's head materialized between the wizards, wavering like a reflection on a rippling pond. I was startled, not by the sorcery, but by Mergen's appearance. He looked just like I remembered him, without one new line in his face. None of the rest of us looked the same. Sara had begun to look something like her mother had back in Jaekor. Not as heavy, not with the strange rolling waddle caused by problems of the joints, but her beauty was going fast. In her, that had been a wonder, stretching on way past the usual early, swift-fading characteristic of Nuang Bo women. She did not talk about it, but it preyed upon her. She had her vanity, and she deserved it. Time is the most wicked of all villains. Morgan was not happy about being called up. I feared he suffered the malaise afflicting Sara. He spoke, and I had no trouble hearing him, though his words were an ethereal whisper.
"I was dreaming. There is a place."
His irritation faded. Pale horror replaced it. And I knew he had been dreaming in the place of bones he described in his own annals.
"A white crow."
We had a problem indeed if he preferred a drift through Kina's dreamscapes to a glimpse of life. Sara told him, "We're ready to strike. The Radisha ordered the Privy Council convened just a little while ago. See what they're doing? Make sure Swan is there." Morgan faded from the mist. Sara looked sad. Goblin and One-Eye began excoriating the standard-bearer for running away. "I saw him," I told them. "Perfectly. I heard him, too. Exactly like I always imagined a ghost would talk." Grinning, Goblin told me,
"That's because you hear what you expect to hear. You aren't really listening with your ears, you know."
One-Eye sneered. He never explained anything to anybody, unless maybe to Gota, if she caught him sneaking back in the middle of the night. Then he would have a story as convoluted as the history of the company itself. Sounding like a woman pretending not to be bitter, Sara said, "You can bring Tobo in. We know there won't be any explosions or fires. And you melted only 2 holes through the tabletop."
"A base canard,"
One-Eye proclaimed.
"That happened only because Frog Face here."
Sara ignored him. Tobo can record what Mergen has to say, so Sleepy can use it later. It's time for us to turn into other people. Send a messenger if Mergen finds out anything dangerous. That was the plan. I was even less enthusiastic about it now. I wanted to stay and talk to my old friend. But this thing was bigger than a bull session, bigger than finding out if Bucket was keeping well. Chapter 6 Mergen drifted through the palace like a ghost. He found that thought vaguely amusing, though nothing made him laugh anymore. A decade and a half in the grave destroyed a man's sense of humor. The rambling stone pile of the palace never changed. Well, it got dustier, and it needed repairs ever more desperately. Credit that to Soulcatcher, who did not like having hordes of people underfoot. Most of the original vast professional staff had been diminished and replaced by occasional casual labor. The palace crowned a sizable hill. Each ruler of Taglios, generation after generation, tagged on an addition. Not because the room was needed, but because that was a memorial tradition. Taglians joked that in another 1,000 years there would be no city, just endless square miles of palace, mostly in ruin. The Radishadra, having accepted that her brother the Prabhendradra had been lost during the Shadow Master Wars, and galvanized by the threat of the Protector's displeasure, had proclaimed herself head of state. Traditionalists in the ecclesiastical community did not want a woman in the role, but the world knew this particular woman had been doing the job practically forever anyway. Her weaknesses existed mainly in the ambitions of her critics. Depending who did the pontificating, she had made one of two great mistakes, or possibly both. One would be betraying the Black Company when it was a well-known fact that nobody ever profited from such treachery. And the other error, of particular popularity with the senior priests, would be that she had erred in employing the Black Company in the first place. The terror of the Shadow Masters being expunged in the interim by agency of the company did not present a counter-argument of any current merit. Unhappy people shared the meeting chamber with the Radisha. The eye automatically went to the Protector first. Soulcatcher looked exactly as she always had. Slimly androgynous, yet sensual, in black leather, a black mask, a black helmet, and black leather gloves. She occupied a seat slightly to the left of and behind the Radisha, within a curtain of shadow. She did not put herself forward, but there was no doubt who made the ultimate decisions. Every hour of every day the Radisha found another reason to regret having let this particular camel shove her nose into the tent. The cost of having tried to get around fulfilling an unhappy promise to the Black Company was unsupportable already. Surely keeping her promises could not have been so painful. What possibly could have happened that would be worse than what she suffered now, had she and her brother helped the captain find the way to Katavar. At desks to either hand, facing one another from 15 feet, stood scribes who struggled valiantly to record anything said. One group served the Radisha. The other was in Soulcatcher's employ. Once upon a time there had been disagreements after the fact about decisions made during a Privy Council meeting. A table 12 feet long and 4 wide faced the two women. 4 men sat behind its inadequate bulwark. Willow Swan was situated at the left end. His once marvelous golden hair had gone gray and stringy. At higher elevations, it had grown extremely sparse. Swan was a foreigner. Swan was a bundle of nerves. Swan had a job he did not want but could not give up. Swan was riding the tiger. Willow Swan headed up the Greys in the public eye. In reality, he was barely a figurehead. If his mouth opened, the words that came out were pure Soulcatcher. popular hatred deservedly belonging to the Protector, settled upon Willow Swan instead. Seated with Swan were three Running Dog senior priests who owed their standing to the Protector's favor. They were small men in large jobs. Their presence at council meetings was a matter of form. They would not take part in any actual debate, though they might receive instructions. Their function was to agree with and support Soulcatcher, if she happened to speak. Significantly, all three represented Goonie cults. Though the Protector used the Greys to enforce her will, the Shadar had no voice in the council. Neither did the Vedna. That minority simmered continuously because Soulcatcher arrogated to herself much that properly applied only to God, the Vedna being hopelessly monotheistic and stubborn about keeping it that way. Swan was a good man inside his fear. He spoke for the Shadar when he could. There were two other men, of more significance, present. They were positioned behind tall desks located back of the table. They perched atop tall stools and peered down at everyone like a pair of lean old vultures. Both antedated the coming of the Protector, who had not yet found a suitable excuse for getting rid of either, though they irritated her frequently. The right-hand desk belonged to the Inspector General of the Records, Chandra Gokhale. His was a deceptive title. He was no glorified clerk. He controlled finances and most public works. He was ancient, hairless, lean as a snake, and twice as mean. He owned his appointment to the Radish's father. Until the latter days of the Shadowmaster Wars, his office had been a minor one. The wars caused that office's influence and power to expand, and Chandra Gokhale was never shy about snatching at any strand of bureaucratic power that came within reach. He was a staunch supporter of the Radisha and a steadfast enemy of the Black Company. He was also the sort of weasel who would change all that in an instant if he saw sufficient advantage in so doing. The man behind the desk on the left was more sinister. Arjana Drupada was a priest of Ravi Lemna's cult, but there was not one ounce of brotherly love in the man. His official title was Purohita, which meant more or less that he was the royal chaplain. In actuality, he was the true voice of the priesthoods at court. They had forced him upon the Radisha at a time she was making desperate concessions in order to gain support. Like Gokhale, Drupada was more interested in control than he was in doing what was best for Taglios. But he was not an entirely cynical manipulator. His frequent moral bulls got up the Protector's nose more often even than the constant quibbling financial caveats of the Inspector General. Physically, Drupada was known for his shock of wild white hair. That clung to his head like a mad haystack, the good offices of a comb being completely unfamiliar. Only Gokhale and Drupada seemed unaware that their days had to be numbered. The Protector of all the Taglias was not enamored of them at all. The final member of the council was absent, which was not unusual. The great General Mogaba preferred to be in the field, harrying those designated as his enemies. He viewed the infighting in the palace with revulsion. None of which mattered at the moment. There had been incidents. There were witnesses to be brought forward. The Protector was not pleased. Willow Swan rose. He beckoned a gray sergeant out of the gloom behind the two old men.
"Gobble Singh!"
Nobody remarked on the unusual name. Possibly he was a convert. Stranger things were happening.
"The Singh's patrol watches an area immediately outside the palace on the north side. This afternoon, one of his patrolmen discovered a prayer wheel mounted on one of the memorial posts in front of the north entrance. 12 copies of this sutra were attached to the arms of the wheel."
Swan made a show of turning a small paper card so the light would fall upon the writing there. The lettering appeared to be in the ecclesiastical style. Swan failed to appreciate his own ignorance of Taglian letters, though. He was holding the card inverted. He did not, however, make any mistakes when he reported what the prayer card had to say.
Raja Dharma, the duty of kings. Know you. Kingship is a trust. The king is the most exalted and conscientious servant of the people.
Swan did not recognize the verse. It was so ancient that some scholars attributed it to one or another of the Lords of Light in the time when the gods still handed down laws to the fathers of men. But the Radishadra knew it. The Pirohita knew it. Someone outside the palace had leveled a chiding finger. Soulcatcher understood it too. Its object, she said.
Only a Bodhi monk would presume to chastise this house, and they are very few.
That pacifistic, moralistic cult was young and still very small, and it had suffered during the war years almost as terribly as had the followers of Kina. The Bodhi refused to defend themselves.
I want the man who did this!
The voice she used was that of a quarrelsome old man.
Swan
said. It was not wise to argue with the protector, but that was an assignment beyond the capacities of the Greys. Among Soulcatcher's more frightening characteristics was her seeming ability to read minds. She could not, really, but never insisted that she could not. In this instance, she found it convenient to let people believe what they wanted. She told Swan,
Being Bodhi, he will surrender himself. No search will be necessary.
Huh? There is a tree, sometimes called the Bodhi tree, in the village of Semki. It is a very old and highly honored tree. The Bodhi enlightened one made his reputation loafing in the shade of this tree. The Bodhi consider it their most holy shrine. Tell them I will make kindling wood out of the Bodhi tree unless the man who rigged that prayer wheel reports to me. Soon.
Soulcatcher employed the voice of a petty, vindictive old woman. Murgan made a mental note to send Sara a suggestion that the guilty man be prevented from reaching the protector. Destruction of a major holy place would create thousands of new enemies for Soulcatcher. Willow Swan started to speak, but Soulcatcher interrupted.
I do not care if they hate me, Swan. I care that they do what I tell them to do when I tell them to do it. The Bodhi will not raise a fist against me anyway. That would put a stain on their karma.
A cynical woman, the protector.
Get on with it, Swan.
Swan sighed.
Several more of those smoke shows appeared tonight. One was much bigger than any seen before. Once again, the Black Company's sigil was part of all of them.
He brought forward another Shadar witness, who told of being stoned by the mob, but did not mention the demon Nyasi. The news was no surprise. It was one of the reasons the council had been convened. With no real passion, the Radisha demanded,
How could that happen? Why can't you stop it? You have men on every street corner. Chandra!
She appealed to the man who knew just how much it would cost to put all those Greys out there. Gokhale inclined his head imperially. As long as the Radisha did the questioning, Swan's nerve stood up. She could not hurt him in ways he had not been hurt before. Not the way the Protector could. He asked,
Have you been out there? You should disguise yourself and go. Like Sarah goes in the fairy tale. Every street is clogged with people. Thousands sleep where others have to walk over them. Breezeways and alleyways are choked with human waste. Sometimes the press is so thick you can murder somebody 10 feet from one of my men and never be noticed. The people playing these games aren't stupid. If they're really company survivors, they're especially not stupid. They've already survived everything ever thrown at them. They're using the crowds for cover exactly the way they'd use the rocks and trees and bushes out in the countryside. They don't wear uniforms. They don't stand out. They're not outlanders anymore. If you really want to nail them, put out a proclamation saying they all have to wear funny red hats.
Swan's nerve had peaked high. That was not directed at the Radisha. Soulcatcher, speaking through her, had issued several proclamations memorable for their absurdity.
Being steeped in company doctrine, they wouldn't be anywhere around when the smoke emblems actually formed. So far, we haven't even figured out where they come from.
Soulcatcher unleashed a deep-throated grunt. It said she doubted that Swan could figure out much of anything. His nerve guttered like a dying lamp. He began to sweat. He knew he walked a tightrope with the mad woman. He was tolerated like a naughty pet for reasons clear only to the sorceress, who sometimes did things for no better reason than a momentary whim, which could reverse itself an instant later. He could be replaced. Others had been. Soulcatcher did not care about facts, insurmountable obstacles, or mere difficulties. She cared about results. Swan offered. On the plus side, there's no evidence, even from our most eager informants, that suggests this activity is anything but a low-grade nuisance. Even if Black Company survivors are behind it, and even with tonight's escalation. Soulcatcher said, "They'll never be anything but a nuisance." Her voice was that of a plucky teenage girl.
"They're going through the motions. They lost heart when I buried all their leaders."
That was all spoken in a powerful male voice by someone accustomed to unquestioning obedience. But those words amounted to an oblique admission that company members might, after all, still be alive. And the final few words included in a rising inflection betraying potential uncertainty. There were questions about what had happened on the plain of Glittering Stone that Soulcatcher herself could not answer.
"I'll worry when they call them back from the dead."
She did not know. In truth, little had gone according to anyone's plan out there. Her escape with Swan had been pure luck. But Soulcatcher was the sort who believed Fortune's bright countenance was her born due.
"Probably true, and only marginally significant if I understand your summons."
"There are other forces afoot,"